You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Sophie Grove and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with ABC's London correspondent Jeffrey Coffin. Jeffrey, what do you have for us today?
Well, good morning. We're going to follow the Pope to Latin America, his first overseas trip. Can he save the Catholic Church on that continent?
We also get the latest on the negotiations between Serbia and Kosovo and review their astonishing progress.
Plus, despite being torn apart by 27 years of civil war, Angola is fast becoming an economic powerhouse on the continent. But as the rich get richer, who's being left behind?
Plus, we go for a sniff around Vanuatu to see how sandalwood is being used in luxury perfume.
We realised that people weren't seeing their products, such as sandalwood, being produced to an end products, and we wanted to help the people out in a social enterprise to do that.
So all that, plus we'll play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Three people have died after a boat carrying over 150 suspected asylum seekers bound for Australia sank off the south coast of the Indonesian island of Java. Those who died were two women and a 12-year-old boy from Sri Lanka. The head of West Java's search and rescue office says the survivors have been taken to a temporary immigration holding facility. The latest accident at sea involving boat people came less than a week after Australia slammed the door on would-be refugees with a deal to send all boat arrivals to Papua New Guinea for assessment and eventual settlement. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says the latest sinking has shown the need for a change of policy.
Say that all of our agencies are actively following this and ensuring that everything that can be done is being done. This underlines the need for policy changes in Australia on asylum seekers policy, which sends a very clear message to people smugglers to stop sending people by boat to Australia. We are seeing too many drownings, we are seeing too many sinkings, too many innocent people being lost at sea.
Egypt's Interior Ministry says 12 people have been injured in a bomb attack on a police station in a province north of Cairo. Unknown attackers threw the bomb from a passing car in Mansoura, the capital of Dakhalia province, according to security sources. And at least one supporter of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi has been killed in a protest march in Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood said on its website that police in civilian clothes had opened fire on Morsi supporters, killing two and injuring others. More than 100 Bulgarian lawmakers, ministers and journalists have been escorted out of parliament early today after being trapped inside for about 8 hours by anti-corruption protesters who'd gathered outside. The demonstrators had been involved in clashes with riot police on the 40th day of rallies against government corruption. Several protesters and at least one police officer have reportedly been injured. US Vice President Joe Biden has continued his visit to India by telling political leaders he supports both Washington and New Delhi's new focus on the Asia-Pacific region. Mr. Biden's in India on a four-day visit to bolster economic and defense ties as part of President Obama's rebalance towards Asia-Pacific. He was attending a banquet in Delhi hosted by the Indian President Pranab Mukherjee.
As you look east, we strongly support your efforts integrate your economies more with those countries to your east. We are looking west in our desire to form a greater economic union with regard to the Pacific Basin. The reason for my visit is, on the first floor, to make it clear that we truly value this relationship.
Lawyers for the disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong have asked a US District Court judge to dismiss a lawsuit brought by a former teammate. Papers filed in Washington on Tuesday claim Floyd Landis should be barred from suing Armstrong for fraud because Landis, like Armstrong, took performance-enhancing drugs. Landis filed the suit under a federal law that allows whistleblowers to report fraud in exchange for a reward. The False Claims Act allows whistleblowers to sue over suspected fraud involving government money and, if successful, get a percentage of whatever the government recovers. A silent auction with a difference in New York City has raised nearly $250,000 from works by artists like Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol and Christo. The event was the idea of clean-up worker Daryl Kelly, and his aim was to raise funds partly to purchase a headstone for a deceased artist whom he never knew. In the summer of 2006, Kelly was called to the West Beth Artists Housing Apartment building in Manhattan's West Village and asked to clean the apartment of a deceased resident, photographer Harry Shunk. Kelly and his crew found an apartment filled almost to the ceiling with boxes and old newspapers.
I look in there with my head and I look from the ground all the way up there. Oh my God. Now my brain is ticking. How are we going to get this out? How are we going to get in here? If I knew what I knew today, nothing would have left without me having somebody there talking to me. Let me know, you know, what the value of this stuff was. You know what I mean? And how valuable Harry was.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. That's what I call quite a dedicated fan to his work, huh?
Happy Harry.
Happy Harry, indeed. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti cece.
From London, London.
London, caralho.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove. Well, now it is time for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is ABC's London correspondent, Jeffrey Kaufman. Welcome back to the show, Jeffrey. May I ask, where are you going to begin today?
Good morning, first of all. And let me say that we are on our agenda today is not the royal baby. All right. I want to quote the cover of Private Eye magazine, which I think kind of sums it up. Woman has baby. And that really, after all of this fuss, 70 cameras out there yesterday, we can now move the agenda forward.
It was quite insane, wasn't it?
Hurrah. And actually, a couple of papers, including The Independent here in the UK, haven't run with that story on the front page. So good on them, really.
Yeah. But you know what the brutal reality of that one is? Their sales will suffer. I mean, we can be all sort of high and mighty about serious journalism and, you know, and I kind of am guilty of that. But the fact is, people want to read about this stuff.
You have to give what people want, don't you?
Well, you don't necessarily have to, but if you're running a news business, and most of these news organizations are businesses, that is what people consume voraciously. I was talking to the editor of one news organization's online services, and they said nothing in that no news story, this is an American one, spikes like the royals. That it is the biggest, most popular news story they can put online. And so
the Americans have always had a love affair, though, with the royal family, haven't they?
Yeah. They got rid of the royals, and now they love them, yeah.
True, they miss them. Well, let's not talk about that anymore.
We didn't talk about that. Okay, that's good. Okay, have a good day, guys.
what should we talk about?
What I do want to talk about, actually, Pope Francis on his first overseas trip in Brazil. First of all, in Rio yesterday, a bit of a mess. The driver took a wrong turn, and he got caught in the famous Rio traffic. It was a bit chaotic. Also, some of the political, some political spillback against the trip that's costing the government of Brazil $50 million. Some resentment given this huge uprising against corruption and government inefficiency in Brazil. But I'm more interested, frankly, he's there for World Youth Day, by the way, which is Thursday in Rio. Something that happens every two World Catholic Youth Day, obviously. Which happens every 2 years. It's in Rio on the beach this week. But what's interesting to me, I covered Latin America for ABC for 10 years. You know, they talk about almost half of the world's 1.2 billion Catholics are in Latin America. The two biggest Catholic nations in the world, Mexico and Brazil. And yet participation rate in the church in those countries is declining. It's dropping like a stone. And, you know, they used to call in the Catholic Church Latin America, South America, the continent of hope. And now, as one wag called it, it's the continent of concern, because they are hemorrhaging membership. They just simply can't keep them. And it's a huge challenge. And even a Latin American pope, the first in history, is going to have real trouble saving the church in Latin America.
And do you think Pope Francis, he is Argentinian, but he's also quite a modern pope if you compare him to his predecessor. Do you think that might help entice people back into the church in this very, this nation that is full of youth and contemporary culture that is Brazil?
Here's the problem. The church is extraordinarily hierarchical. It has a huge shortage of priests. And it isn't self-empowering for people. I did a story, I remember, a number of years ago when John Paul II died. I was in Mexico. And the competition for souls in Latin America, it's also true in Africa and really true in the West as well, is through the evangelical churches. And I went to an evangelical church in Mexico City and to a service. And I said, you know, how many of you were Catholics, fue católicos? And they all put up their hands. And I said, why did you leave the Catholic Church? There are about 40 or 50 people in this very modest, kind of scruffy basement room for an evangelical church service. Protestant evangelical, of course. And I said, why did you leave? And one woman said, my husband's an alcoholic. He left me. I have 5 children. I couldn't pay the bills. My neighbor said, come with me to this evangelical church. Oh, she said, I went to the priest. He said, say 50 Hail Marys. And, you know, I didn't have food. I couldn't pay the electric bill. My children were going hungry. My neighbors had come to this evangelical church. The people embraced me. They gave me food. My husband is now off alcohol. He's back with me. You know, they got involved. And she said, this church has saved my marriage and my family. And I said, would you ever go back to the Catholic Church? She said, nothing would make me go back. And that is the challenge. People need hands-on guidance leadership. The Catholic Church simply isn't disposed to do that. It is a huge problem. You know, you can talk numerically about the vast number of Catholics in Latin America. No, I don't think that Pope Francis can say that. He might, in a small way, have some influence. But the Church's problems are more connecting with a continent of very young people.
Let's move on to another story. He's the New York politician that just keeps on giving, doesn't he?
Well, you know, it's sizzling in New York this summer, and we ain't just talking about the temperature. Anthony Weiner, the sexting scandal that brought him down from Congress. And then the guy, to the horror of the New York media, just announces he's running for New York mayor. And what really horrifies the media in New York is that he's been number one in the race for mayor over Christine Quinn, the woman
who's quite far ahead in the polls as well.
Well, he has been until yesterday. And yesterday we learned that, in fact, the sexting, the sending of lewd pictures online that led to his resignation in Congress appears to have continued long after. And there was his dutiful wife standing next to him yesterday saying, I know I still stand by my husband. We've been through some tough times. It's going to be interesting. I mean, I think this is a good one on the agenda, because this is the question of public, private behavior and public morality. And, you know, he's clearly a very competent politician. He's clearly popular. But at some point, are these kind of lewd images and his behavior appropriate for a man as mayor of one of the world's largest cities? It's going to be interesting to see. He says he's staying in the race, and you know, and he's got good company. Elliot Spitzer, the man who resigned as governor of New York State in 2008, running for comptroller of New York, the man in charge of the city's finances. Elliot Spitzer was involved in a prostitution scandal back then. Is redemption possible in New York? We will see.
And it's interesting to see his very beautiful wife. She's actually incredibly intelligent and also a top aide of Hillary Clinton, Huma Abedin. It's interesting to see her rallying again and forgiving him in public. This idea of the wife as this moral arbiter is really important in these political moments.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton did that too. You know, if you may remember the famous 60 Minutes interview when during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, she said, "I'm not just standing in some dutiful housewife standing by my man." She presented herself as an intelligent spouse, and she understood her husband's shortcomings. And in many ways, these are private matters, but it really, you know, the U.S. loves to tear itself apart over morality issues like this. And boy, they don't get more interesting or spicy than this one.
But sometimes these kind of things also help politicians. It really can humanize, I think. People can sometimes relate to them a little more than they otherwise would have.
You know, I think you're right. I guess the question is whether a second chapter to this sexting is just one chapter too many. I guess we will see. It certainly has thrown people, the so-called pundits in the U.S. that Wiener, who was disgraced and left, and you know all these jokes about his last name and those pictures, somehow that didn't bother people, and that in the polls he was way ahead. So is there a line, and what do you have to do? You know, Governor Mark Sanford. Now in Congress, having also resigned in a sex scandal in North Carolina. I mean, the Americans seem quite prepared to forgive. I mean, let's look at Bill Clinton, too. Yeah. It really is fascinating to watch. So a good one on our agenda today.
Excellent stuff, Jeffrey. We're going to have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House. Good as always.
Thanks, guys.
Coming up, we review the agenda of the latest talks between the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo.
Election Day in Zimbabwe is almost upon us. 5 years since the historic power-sharing deal between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, Monocle 24 assesses how the political landscape's changed since Election Day 2008 and what's at stake for the country and the continent in this year's vote. From the economy to the arts to freedom of speech, we'll unpick the key issues at play as Zimbabweans head to the polls. Zimbabwe Votes, a series of special reports, all next week, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove and Phil Hahn. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, describes the progress being made between Kosovo and Serbia in the last few months as astonishing. A 13-year constitutional deadlock was broken when the two sides agreed to initial agreement in April that saw prospects for Kosovo recognition and the opening of negotiations between the European Union and Serbia.
Well, 3 months since that agreement, leaders from Serbia and Kosovo are meeting in Brussels today for the latest round of talks. Well, joining us on the line now to discuss what's top of the agenda are Guy Delaney in Belgrade and Charlotte MacDonald Gibson in Brussels. Welcome to the show, both of you. Charlotte, let's begin with you over there in Brussels. The two prime ministers meeting today. What's top of the agenda?
Well, the main item that they're going to be bashing out today is local elections in Kosovo in early November. So they're going to get down to the nitty-gritty of things like candidate lists. A big issue is this northern enclave of Mitrovica in northern Kosovo, where the vast majority of Serbs in Kosovo live. And this was at the crux of the deal that was struck in April, when the Kosovans agreed to give the Serbs living there a certain amount of autonomy, while the Serbian government agreed in principle that Kosovo had control over the police and other state functions there. So now it's getting down to implementing, as I said, the nitty-gritty of this broad deal that was agreed to in April.
And Guy, I wondered what the perspective is in Belgrade. I mean, we've seen quite a lot of astonishing progress, as Catherine Ashton put it. What's the view in Serbia? They weren't very happy initially when Kosovo declared independence, in fact, in 2008. But it does seem that recognition has changed things dramatically.
Well, you get a completely different view in Belgrade compared to Mitrovica, for example, Sophie. And another thing I must stress here is that Serbia has said it will never recognise the independence of Kosovo. What we've got here really is a normalisation of relations. You can dress it up in any way you like, and Serbia is desperately trying to, but it's very keen to say that it's not recognising the independence of Kosovo. Frankly, I think a lot of people in Belgrade in particular don't really care anymore. They've felt that this is a problem which has weighed around the necks of Serbia for the past dozen years or so, and that really they want to move forward in a different direction now, and that direction's westward towards the European Union. Meanwhile, in Mitrovica and in the rest of northern Kosovo, you've got about 50 or 60,000 ethnic Serbs there who are rather feeling like they've been sold out. Now what's going to be happening in Brussels is the Prime Minister's Dacic and Tachi will be trying to work out a way of making it acceptable for North Kosovo Serbs to participate in these elections, which is a tricky matter really, because if Kosovo is an independent country, then how can these Serbs who consider themselves citizens of Serbia take part in the elections? Now, that's one of the meaty issues they'll be wrangling with.
And guys, Serbian officials, they've already told leaders in northern Kosovo that the interim assembly, which has been set up, is out of step with the initial agreement. So there definitely are some big hurdles in the way. I just want to head back to Charlotte over there in Brussels. Guy mentioned this is all about admission to the European Union. How much is Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign policy chief, really riding on getting this to happen?
Yes, well, this deal reached in April has really been seen as a classic example of how the enlargement policy of the EU is a real tool for bringing the peace and stability to the continent. Serbia has been given a date now to start its European Union accession talks, and Kosovo will be following suit. So it has been hailed really as one of the rare successes really for Catherine Ashton and the European Union's foreign policy office.
And I wondered also, perhaps one for you, Guy, how this plays into the international context. I mean, it's quite interesting to look at the Kosovo website. Kosovo people, thank you, looking at the different people who did recognise Kosovo and really sort of have been the driving force behind that. A few people not on that list still, many countries with separatist movements. I wondered whether or not there are still, you know, it still is dividing the ranks at the UN, and whether this could really be a moment of change in that context.
Well, at the moment, Kosovo's got, I think, slightly over 50% of UN member states to recognise, at 99 nations at the last count. Of course, the major refuseniks are Russia and China, along with Serbia. And you're right about talking about separatist movements. Spain certainly doesn't back Kosovo's independence for obvious reasons. Cyprus as well doesn't. You know, I think 5 out of the 28 now EU member states haven't backed Kosovo's independence, and many others have backed up Serbia's stance. And it really was a bit of a can of worms that was opened when Kosovo was backed in declaring its independence unilaterally 5 years ago. I don't think a lot of states had particularly thought through what the implications might be, even in their own countries. The real turning point, yes, you're right, Serbia normalising relations with Kosovo may have an impact on that, and how far Serbia goes in terms of recognising the legitimacy of the Republic of Kosovo's various institutions will probably be a guide for which other states do recognise Kosovo, because at the moment it's quite difficult for Kosovo to function as a state. It doesn't have an international telephone dialing code, for example. That's just one matter of a day-to-day problem that you have there. You get a Monaco dialing code if you pick up a mobile phone in Kosovo at the moment. It doesn't function as a regular country. It's got more than 50% unemployment. It's got an enormous international presence there. And it is very difficult for it to move forward as a credible standalone state while it doesn't have this level of international recognition.
Well, Guy Delaunay in Belgrade and Charlotte MacDonald Gibson in Brussels, thank you for joining us today.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama
to Amsterdam
to Cairo
to Karachi
to Bogota. All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove, where the time here in London is 8:24. Well, since gaining independence in 1975, the West African country of Angola has had a bumpy road to where we are today. For more than 25 years, the country was torn apart during a brutal civil war. Millions of Angolans were killed and millions more made refugees. It was only in 2002 that a ceasefire agreement was finally signed.
Since that day, more than 10 years ago, Angola has seen radical transformation. The country is rich in natural resources, especially oil, and an influx of foreign money has flowed in, helping to make Angola one of the wealthiest countries on the continent. One man who's travelled to the country to tell the story of Angola's people, from the wealthiest to the poorest, is Daniel Metcalfe, author of Blue Dahlia, Black Gold, A Journey into Angola. Daniel joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks.
So tell me why you chose this very interesting country as a subject of a book. It's very much a travelogue. It's very much a journey that you took, observing some of the very curious details in the country that are very much unreported.
I suppose I was just fascinated by the fact that it seemed so hostile to outsiders to come. There are so many blocks in the way of anyone who wants to visit. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. Luanda, its capital, is the most expensive city in the world now. It is hard to get a seat on a plane. It is the visas are hard. I mean, everything about it is just going uphill. And I think that was the challenge that sort of first drew me. And the more I read about it, the more I found that it was just a complex, rich and fascinating place. And I just wanted to delve in further.
Don't you say it's a very complex country, of course, and indeed it is. But this divide between the very rich getting richer and the poor still very much living in poverty across most of the country. What was that divide like experiencing, I guess, firsthand crisscrossing the country?
Well, it was very apparent. I mean, from the moment you land in Luanda, you've got a lot of slums, which are called Musekh, and they are, I mean, 80% of the population of Luanda live in these slums. Meanwhile, you've got a small number of the population who live extremely wealthily and extravagantly. So, I mean, just to give you an example, you don't generally get beggars on the streets, but if someone does ask you for money, it might be for an awful lot of money. It might be for $100. Someone asked me for $100 on the street.
Wow.
No one has done that in London or New York or Moscow. So it's a place of extremes, and it is apparent wherever you go. Outside Luanda, it's slightly balances out a little bit. But it's a country where a vast number of people live simply and in extreme poverty. So, you know, you can't get away from that.
And in terms of the effect that oil is having on the society, did you see any sort of first-hand accounts of really the devastating effects of not just the oil money that's distorting the economy, but environmental effects of what's going on there?
The environmental impact isn't talked about very much. A lot of the oil is offshore, so you don't see it. Some of it's onshore. I think when you go to a place like Soyo, which is just next to the vast Block Zero, you've got a lot of oil there, and you've got a lot of gas. You've got a new LNG liquefied natural gas plant that's just been built, and there you do get a sense of it. Even the smell in the air. I mean, you see the flares burning as you come in by bus. You can even smell it in the air. Locals talk about how mango trees now have a sort of different hue. There's a sort of black fuzz that grows on it, and the traditional forms of agriculture have been broken there. But people need to do more work and need to report on it, because it's out of the public eye, this.
And I guess that's the broader issue at hand here, isn't it? It's the rapid development of this African country, and in a sense, it's really leading the way on the continent. How do you think Angola's role coming in the future will perhaps shape Africa as a whole?
I think it's really interesting. This, in a way, it's leading Africa in putting up the middle finger to the international donors, just saying we don't need your money. And in a way they do. It's interesting that in 2009 Angola took a very large standby agreement loan from the IMF to balance its books. But there is money sloshing around, and it is able to say we don't need other people's help. And I think you're seeing something similar in Mozambique and other African countries where there's a lot of oil coming on stream. And I think that is going to be something to watch. they're rightfully very proud. They have a large army. They could be regional power brokers. But there's that pride that comes with having a lot of very valuable resources that I think is affecting the mentality in a certain way. It's certainly one to watch.
And you talk about the mentality. The book addresses some of the curiosities of the way that Angolans think, the complex history that really has made the modern nation what it is. This figure of Salazar, I was very struck by that legacy when I was in Mozambique recently, that colonial legacy that really underpins this country is very underreported in some ways.
There's a really interesting relationship that Angola has with its former colonial power. There are a lot of Portuguese working in Angola now, something like 230,000. Whereas you had Portuguese who were fighting to keep their African colonies in the 1960s and 70s, and a lot of people dying for it, they're now coming back a generation later, 30-odd years later, coming back to get jobs. And it's that sort of reversal of fortunes that I think is interesting. And the way Angola looks at Portugal, well, it's partly triumphalist. It's quite proud that, you know, we've beaten it, we've become independent. But I think on the other hand, there's a great fondness for the Portuguese language. You know, that's what most people in Luanda speak and speak it very well.
The book is called Blue Dahlia, Black Gold, A Journey into Angola. And in 2009, you released another book, Lost People of Central Asia, kind of following, I guess, on a bit on a similar theme, but very interesting. Daniel Metcalf, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. In the next half hour of the program, we'll be getting the latest news from France. We'll be reviewing this morning's Latin American papers as well. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Thanks, Phil. Three people have died after a boat carrying over 150 suspected asylum seekers bound for Australia sank off the south coast of the Indonesian island of Java. Those who died were two women and a 12-year-old boy. Egypt's Interior Ministry says 12 people have been injured in a bomb attack on a police station in a province north of Cairo. And the Muslim Brotherhood says police in civilian clothes have opened fire on a protest march by supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi, killing two and injuring others. More than 100 Bulgarian lawmakers, ministers and journalists have been escorted out of Parliament early today after being trapped inside for about 8 hours by anti-corruption protesters who'd gathered outside. US Vice President Joe Biden has continued his visit to India by telling political leaders he supports both Washington and New Delhi's new focus on the Asia-Pacific region. He's in India on a 4-day visit to bolster economic and defence ties as part of President Obama's rebalance towards Asia-Pacific. Lawyers for the disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong have asked a US District Court judge to dismiss a lawsuit brought by a former teammate. Papers filed in Washington claim Floyd Landis should be barred from suing Armstrong for fraud because Landis, like Armstrong, took performance-enhancing drugs. Landis filed the suit under a federal law that allows whistleblowers to report fraud in exchange for a reward. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney, we'll be back at 9 o'clock, top of the hour, with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove. Now, for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, we're heading a bit off the beaten track. The islands of Vanuatu aren't exactly abundant with natural resources, but the sandalwood trade has played a major, sometimes brutal, role in their history.
The essential oil is used in everything from aromatherapy through to high-end French perfumes and remains extremely valuable. While in Port Vila, Monocle's Patrick Pittman spoke to a couple who have turned their back on two decades in the Australian sandalwood trade to help islanders set up their own industry, harvesting and distilling oil on the island.
I'm just leaving Malay Village near Port Vila with Jeff and Susie Allen of Pacific Provender. Jeff's been talking to the local pastor about the work they're doing with the community on Aramango, which is one of Vanuatu's more remote islands.
I've worked in the essential oil industries for the last 24 years and have been interested in sandalwood distillation for years and got the chance to come to Aramango to have a look at a project, and we realised that the country, the people weren't seeing their products such as sandalwood being produced to an end products, and we wanted to help the people out in a social enterprise to do that.
When we went to Aramango 9 years ago, we were taken by the people we met on the island, and a resource-rich island of people that understood their farming practices so well, weren't really receiving any benefit whatsoever from it that we could see in a monetary terms, and for supporting their community projects, and education was a real issue, which was a special interest of mine. So it really changed our life direction in many ways, that trip 9 years ago, where we thought, well, combined Jeff and my skills, we could actually help start a realistic business on this island.
And what is it that your business does differently to many of the other people dealing in sandalwood on these islands?
Our main business difference is we actually pay the farmers a fair price for the wood, but then all of a sudden the farmers are actually, and the community members are involved in the actual processing of the wood into the oil. And then also we're offering farmers and people in the community that have got ideas to develop other small micro industries from our process. We can help them along by supplying oil, so they may decide to make soap or shampoo, etc., etc. So we're there to mentor. We see our business as a nucleus and then hopefully grow out from there.
And look, how do you do this stuff right? How do you make sure you're doing things that these communities, these islanders, actually need and want, and that put long-term sustainable practices in place, as opposed to just dropping in whatever you think might be a good idea?
Well, exactly what you said, what the villagers, what the people actually want. We've got a knowledge and the technology, or if we haven't got it, we can find it to actually transfer it to local population and villages, but you actually let them come to you and tell you what they want, and you don't go and dictate what they should do. Maybe you can see a small opportunity, but you actually just do a little suggestion. Don't actually say what you think, but do a little suggestion, see if that idea grows within themselves, and they'll come back to you. So it's really letting them tell you what they want to do.
Robbie White is a pastor for the congregation of Williams Bay on Erromango. He's been working with Jeff and Susie to bring the sandalwood distillery to their island and bring work to the community. Erromango's history with sandalwood is dark and complicated, with many of Robbie's ancestors kidnapped and sold into slavery in Australia while traders stripped the islands of their resources, and in turn the islanders slaughtered visiting missionaries mistaken for traders. I asked Robbie to explain a little of this difficult background.
Erromango was it is an island that just back from history, it was an island with a lot of sandalwood trees growing in the coast of the island, and also in the pools. So this is where traders were coming, were interested in sandalwood, and they were coming and they're pulling off the sandalwood from the island, and all the natives didn't like it because they tried to chase them out, but this is what they were doing, and they were trying to kill all the natives. And the reason why the natives were angry, and from that time when the natives were coming and also the missionary were coming, and it was then when they saw the missionaries, it was traitors. So they murdered all the missionaries. They were murdered because it was because of the sandalwood thing that strong around the island of Erromango.
When people have an image of Vanuatu, they think of places probably like we're sitting now, surrounded by lots of ample tourist facilities and safe water and shops everywhere and that kind of thing. Erromango's not an island like that, though, is it?
Yeah, Erromango is not an island like that. It should be. I mean, we really want to see that Erromango comes up like, which is in Port Vila. But what I was saying is that they took all our resources out. Then those resources should be coming back to Erromango and bring out development and developing the people in the island of Erromango.
And how is it different dealing with the kind of business that Jeff and Susie are trying to set up than, say, just growing the sandalwood and selling it on to traders and the like?
There is a difference here because almost everybody will come. I mean, the island of Erromango people are coming, and the investors, and they're just pulling out all our resources and coming back to other islands. But we are happy because Jeff has an idea that he's bringing a distillery down to the island, where our sandalwood is, and helping the people and distilling the oil and all, and giving the job to the people. So it's one of the things that we happy, and we also happy that it's made from Eromango, all this product. That's why we are really proud of that.
Sandalwood is a recently returned trade to Eromango, so I asked Pastor Robbie about other options for the young people on the island.
They do the gardening, they're using a mini-mill things and cutting the timber, and also the kind of work that people do is getting the lobsters and the coconut crab and all those which people usually have money out of it, yeah.
And what's your vision for Eromango, say, 10 years from now, when you've got productive crops of sandalwood and you're distilling them on the island and you're selling them here on Port Vila and exporting them through the internet and those things? How do you see that the future of the island itself?
We want to see Eromango coming up the standard that the other islands like Port Vila and Sando, and also we want to see the people of Eromango self-reliance themselves, and they know how to do things themselves, yeah, with their own resources.
And that was Patrick Pittman reporting from the islands of Vanuatu for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, which I highly recommend. You can catch the programme tonight.
Why do you recommend it, Sophie?
It happens to be my show. this evening's show, it airs at 1900 London time. Highly, highly recommended. There's also a report by David Pleasant about mafia businesses in Sicily too.
Excellent, which is also being featured in this our latest issue of Mediterranean, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a paired piece. It comes with a print piece too. And David Pleasant was actually in that region for the best part of a week in Calabria and in Sicily. And we've done a two-part series on businesses that are fighting the mafia racket.
It is a good show. I've listened to it. I like The Entrepreneurs.
Thank you. I'm very happy
you're
to
like
have your blessing.
You're like an entrepreneurial expert.
Well, exactly. I'm definitely getting there. I'm putting together the Entrepreneur Guide at the moment. It's going to press this week. So
excellent. That'll be next
exciting.
Month's issue.
Exactly.
Sophie Grove, our entrepreneurs expert extraordinaire, future business leader of the future. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a roundup of the latest news from France.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:42 here in London. That makes it 9:42 in Paris, where we're going to head to next for a roundup of the day's news with our man there, Tom Burgess Watson. Tom, welcome to the show. You're there in Paris, and I think President Hollande and his cabinet are being told to stay put as well.
Good morning to you both. Indeed, President Hollande and his ministers aren't going very far for their summer holidays. The recess begins next week, actually. They're supposed to have 2 weeks of break, but in fact, President Hollande has said to them, it's better if you just have the 1 week and ideally don't go far away. So only one of the ministers is going abroad. The defense minister is going to Spain for his holidays, but the rest of them are all either going to their countryside retreats where they've got cottages or whatnot around the country. And even President Hollande is not going to the presidential fort on the south coast of France. So the fort at Brégançon is a great big castle-type structure. And it's been the place that presidents have gone for a week or two in their summer holidays for decades, for centuries, in fact. But President Hollande is not going there. It's all part of his sort of let's save money and let's appear to be at least a little bit more connected to the people. So not a very exciting set of summer holidays lined up for our ministers here.
But Tom, it's interesting to see how significant this really is in the French psyche, this 2 week holiday on the Côte d'Azur. It's an institution. It's almost a national rite in France. I wonder how people are reacting to this austerity.
Well, it's a very unpopular government anyway. You know, President Hollande's popularity ratings and approval ratings are the lowest seen in modern times. And I think I don't think it's really at this stage going to change a huge amount, the fact that the French president is in Paris or indeed anywhere else for his holidays. It's a difficult one for the PR teams, working out whether actually a couple of snaps of the president looking human on the beach is better than him sitting at home, out of sight perhaps, pretending to sort of count the pennies and eat austere meals at his home in Paris. It's a tricky one, but as you say, a hard one for people in France to relate to, because everyone goes away for a couple of weeks in the summer, and you know, it paints a rather sad picture, to be quite honest.
And quite a startling departure from his predecessor, Nicolas Bling Bling Sarkozy, who favored private jets and, you know, luxurious yachts to spend the summers on. But let's move on to another story which has caught your eye, Tom. Violence across Paris, a few different Paris suburbs, over the enforcement of a ban on full Islamic veils.
Yeah, the weekend, the violence really kicked off, and it was sparked by a rumor amongst the community in this one particular suburb called Trappe, like a trap. It's how it's spelled. It's a fairly sensitive area of the suburb. It's one of those suburbs that does flare up every now and then into violence. And what we saw at the weekend was dozens of cars that were set ablaze, people injured. The whole police station in the area was surrounded by angry protesters who pelted it with stones. And what really triggered it was the enforcement of a law that was passed more than 2 years ago, which bans full Islamic veils. So that's the niqab and the burqa, which cover the face. And it's always been a slightly tricky one to enforce, because the fine is really just a token fine. It's 150 euros, but it's seen as really singling out France as Muslims and making them feel extremely unwelcome. And it was enforced in that area on Friday. A policeman conducted a regular check, issued a ticket to a man who was with a woman wearing the full veil, her husband, in fact, and the man is alleged to have attacked the policeman, which kicked off all this this unrest.
I mean, it's interesting to see how this particular law has been received in those communities. And you mentioned the very difficult real policing task here. Do you think that this really has become part of national law, or is it more of a token?
Well, a few hundred people have now been fined over the 2 years that the law has existed, and I think it's a very difficult one for the French government to get right. In fact, this was introduced by the previous government, and it's now this government that's having to carry on that decision that was taken by Sarkozy's government 2 years ago. But in France, it's a very secular country. There cannot be crucifixes, any religious symbols in any schools, hospitals, anywhere public. And I think that people here in France reached a point where they felt very uncomfortable with people who they couldn't see on the streets of Paris. But to be quite honest, there are only around 400 or 500 French Muslim women to whom the law applied, who actually did wear the full veil. So it really is surprising that it really warranted a law of its own. But I think the French government wanted to tackle it while it was in the sort of the 400 sort of number, not too many people wearing the veil, before it became sort of more into the tens of thousands of people wearing the veil, and then it would be much harder to control. So I think it sends out a message, and you know, it's still quite early days. It's only been around for 2 years, this law, so we'll have to wait and see what its real legacy is. But for the time being, it's seen as a little bit petty, at best, and at worst, it's seen as really singling out a community and making them feel unwelcome.
And Tom, let's just move on to a final story, a bit of a fun one here. Here in London, unfortunately, we can't really swim in the Thames. I think it's just a bit too dirty for that. The closest thing we probably have is what, Hyde Park?
Well, you have the Serpentine there, but Hyde Park's not, it's not the cleanest pond, is it?
It's a little duck, ducky.
Lots of duck droppings. But in Paris, you have your own little summer beach.
We do, but you're not allowed to swim in the River Seine just before you get your get yourself a Eurostar.
Get your tugs on.
You're absolutely not allowed to swim in the Seine. I don't think you'd want to. It's got a very strong current, and it's filthy as well. But all along the banks of the Seine, every year for the last 12 years now, they've been building a platform on what's normally a very busy thoroughfare, covering it in sand, and people are sort of putting umbrellas and deck chairs and things on it. It's a huge long stretch, and whole families go there and lie down in the sun and take showers which are provided there. It's a thing that allows people who can't go away on holiday for whatever reason to feel as though perhaps they are on holiday. And right now, with this heat wave we're having, I suppose it's attracting quite a lot of extra customers, people who are going away on holiday anyway in a few weeks' time, but they can't hold out any longer in their flats in this baking heat, so they're going down there to get a bit of sun and a shower at the same time. There are all sorts of other activities provided there, so it's a sort of fun day out. I've been there once, and I wandered along and had a look at it because I was quite curious about it. But the idea of lying in the sun on what's normally a busy road, about 1 centimeter away from the next person, it doesn't really appeal enormously to me. But it's a fun thing to have a look at, perhaps once.
A fun thing nonetheless. Tom Burgess Watson in Paris. Many thanks for joining us here on the program. Sophie, maybe our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, we can convince him to turn our nice little courtyard into like a Midori House beach.
That'd be lovely.
That would be nice.
Do think we need a pool to splash about in, though. I don't like the idea of just lying, griddling myself.
Well, I can guarantee you that one person who would probably come out in their very short shorts will be our next guest, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You can guarantee to see him on Midori House Beach, maybe even in a pair of red Speedos. Who knows? We're going to be hearing from Fernando in just a couple of minutes. But before that, here is Gilberto Gil with Mercato Atomico.
And that was Gilberto Gil with Mercato Atomico.
And joining us now, sorry Sophie, I cut you off. No, go ahead.
Joining us now in the studio is Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Good morning, Fernando.
Good morning. Good morning, Sophie. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Fernando. We were just talking about Midori House Beach. Would you hit the sand in your Speedos?
Of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Need you even ask?
Oh, yeah.
I love the fact that
And I love swimming. I think I would swim in even the Thames if
would you?
Needed.
I think I might too.
Yeah.
We could keep our heads above the water.
There's a story for us.
I know. Apparently, if you drink 2 pints of Coca-Cola immediately afterwards, you'll be fine.
Perfect.
Which is a worrying thing. That's Thames
folklore. Where did you hear about that?
From my boat friend. We've got some newspapers here, and one of the first stories you've chosen from O Globo is about a bit of a public transportation test for Rio.
Exactly, and apparently didn't really work out. There was some electric problems in the metro system, and basically the whole metro system was paralyzed for 2 hours. So it was very chaotic, because yesterday was the opening mass, you know, that the Pope was at the Copacabana beach, and you know, there's many, many tourists in Rio. I believe there's like 2.5 million at the moment because of this Catholic Youth Festival. So yeah, so it didn't really work out. So, you know, they had to use the buses and everything was crowded. So yeah, and it's interesting today that the transport secretary in Rio said that today everything will run smoothly. But I kind of doubt it, you know, so I hope it will.
It was quite startling. I think it was maybe yesterday when we saw those amazing images of the Pope who took a wrong turn in his Popemobile and he was stuck in, you know, the famous Rio traffic.
Yeah.
Is that what we're going to expect from the World Cup and the 2016 Olympics?
Maybe after this test, they would take care more about those things. No, but look at that. Look at this picture, a beautiful picture on the Globo. It looks like a New Year party in Copacabana, but actually it's not.
But the headline also says Rio fails the transportation test. What is the analysis like from this paper and others about how ready this city is for these big events?
I mean, it's the usual problem in Brazil. You know, we actually have the stadiums, we have everything, but the problem is the infrastructure. We have a kind of a terrible public transport, you know, so I think these things cannot be changed only in 2 years because of those big events. But hopefully you will.
But surely we just had the Confederations Cup, which was still a large event, and we didn't hear horror stories of the transport system collapsing during the tournament, did we?
True, but I believe the Catholic Youth Festival, there's more people in the city than when the Confederations Cup was happening, because the Confederations Cup was all over Brazil. In around 8 cities. So that was different. That was more concentrated in Rio. So shall we move on to other stories? Actually, how Brazilians are actually feeling very cold. So they're not swimming in the beach.
Well, we noticed you're wearing pants today.
Exactly.
I'm feeling in solidarity with your Brazilian counterparts.
Exactly. You know, so so today, for example, in São Paulo, it's a chilly 6 degrees at the moment. And in Rio, a very, very cold 16 degrees.
That's chilly.
That's very chilly for Rio. And it snowed in more than 100 Brazilian cities yesterday. There's a cold wind coming from Antarctica. You know, Brazilians are feeling very cold indeed.
So do they obsess too over weather in the media? Because we've really had a kind of 24-hour news coverage of sunny, essentially.
<It's hot. laughs>
Is it the opposite in Brazil?
I think we do the same, but saying it's cold. And actually, a lot of my friends were taking pictures and posting on social media. And they take pictures, oh, it's 9 degrees where I am now. And I'm like, wow. I was the same when I was there. You know, every day was 8, it was something magical, strange, you know? So it's like the UK when it's 30, you know? It's exactly the same.
And Fernando, finally, we should remember an iconic musician, Brazilian musician, who's died today.
Exactly, very sad news. Dominguinhos, an iconic musician from the Recife in Pernambuco. He died 72 years old, and now I chose a classic, Asa Branca.
Quando ei a terra tendo qual fogueira de São João, eu perguntei a Deus do céu, ai, por que tamanha judiação? Eu perguntei a Deus do céu, ai, por que tamanha judiação? E braseiro.
And that was Fernando Augusto Pacheco with the Brazilian newspapers.
Thanks very much indeed. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Ala John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gaia Lutz, and our studio manager was Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is the latest edition of The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds will be back in the Dory House at the same time tomorrow. And as always, we have lots of stuff coming up in the next couple of hours here on Monocle 24, so please do stay tuned with us. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Sophie Grove.
Saying goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.